From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. In 2014, Americans were outraged to learn how long veterans had to wait to receive medical care. Some soldiers died before they could see a doctor. Today, hundreds of thousands of vets still wait a month or more. That's according to data from the Veterans Affairs Department. Now, some vets have found alternative ways to deal with conditions like PTSD.
Before, while I was overseas, I was working at night. So anytime the sun goes down, I'm ramping up because that's what I do. I work at night. Well, now you come over here, they give you pills to go to sleep, and now you're on these pills and you can't really get your body into a rhythmic fashion. But guess what? The farm can do that.
That's coming up this hour. First, though, Friday, we talked about a Danish study that shows if you're depressed about your job, it's more likely to be your boss, not your workload, that's to blame. Tamika Dupree says that's happened to her.
I loved the job, but I did not like the experience. So much so, it got to the point where actually there were days when I woke up thinking, oh, I don't want to go there. And so it led me to just, you know, resign and move on.
Here are your first thoughts. On Facebook, Wanda Dodd Hardman writes, as a retired HR director, I can vouch that this was the number one complaint when an employee came into my office. Sadly, the ones in charge are the problem, and there's nothing can be done to change the work environment management creates. Kat Keene agrees, so very true, nothing can ruin a workplace like ineffective management. Their inability or desire to create a positive work environment affects the entire office. And we got this from Rhonda S. Kirby. I found this to be quite accurate. I sometimes felt stressed from a workload that seemed overwhelming, but not depressed. On the other hand, even with a light workload, if my boss has been unpleasant or incompetent, I found that to be quite depressing. We love to get your work stories and all your stories, actually. You can call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457, tweet us at OST Talk, or post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio, and we might feature your comments on the show. So let's take a moment and forget about the presidential race, just for a moment, and let's talk about the Senate. In Georgia, the contest to win a Senate seat is much more competitive than anybody predicted. Republican incumbent Johnny Isaacson is just a few percentage points ahead of a relative unknown Democrat, and the independent Alan Buckley just might force a runoff like he did a few years ago. Here to tell us more is Tamar Hallerman. She's the Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Good morning, Tamar.
Thanks for having me.
So when I say that nobody expected this, as I understand it, some Democrats are now saying they regret getting into the race. Why did people not think this would be close?
Johnny Isaacson is such a well-known guy in Georgia. He's been in the Senate for two terms. He came into this year with more than $5 million in the bank, a lot of money. That intimidated a lot of people, a lot of Democrats who people thought, you know, maybe they could present a sizable challenge to Isaacson. All of them, you know, decided they didn't want to run. So for the longest time, it looked like he wasn't going to have any competition.
So now we have this relative unknown. Can you qualify that for me? How unknown is the Democratic challenger?
Sure. Nobody knew who Jim Barksdale was before he qualified for the race in March. We didn't know until a few days before the period to throw your hat into the race closed who the Democratic Party was going to bring as kind of their handpicked candidate. His background is in investment management. You know, he wasn't a known political force or anything like that. So he really started with a clean slate.
And he's pumped over $3 million into his own race. Let's hear a little bit of an ad from Jim Barksdale, the Democrat in the race, talking about how he's an outsider.
I'm Jim Barksdale. I'm not a politician, and I can prove it. I wear this hat. I'm an investment manager, and I stood against the Wall Street crowd to protect my client's retirement. Now, I'm running for the Senate to stand against the Washington crowd and their bad trade deals, wasteful spending, and mass incarceration.
Jim Barksdale ended up getting a really huge percentage of the African-American vote in and around Atlanta, a lot of the younger vote. Why do you think, Tamar, he is going after this outsider title as a Democrat?
Well, for starters, that has proven to be a really potent message for candidates on both sides of the aisle in this election cycle. That's really about bucking the establishment of both parties. You saw that not only with Donald Trump, with Ted Cruz, but also on the Democratic side with Bernie Sanders. So that seems to really be the message this year. It's also interesting, Mr. Barksdale is kind of playing to that Bernie Sanders crowd when he's talking about trade deals. He talks about money in politics. Those are also things that Donald Trump talks about, too. So he's trying to appeal to both sides of the aisle on that.
And yet we're going to hear this clip from a Johnny Isaacson ad. Johnny Isaacson has actually gotten some pretty strong, high-ranking support from Democrats, from a couple former governors and former senators. And he's doing it without really mentioning the presidential race. Let's listen to this ad where the voice that you hear is the mother of a Peace Corps worker. The worker was murdered in the nation of Benin.
So much was done to honor her, and a lot of that is due to Johnny Isaacson. He keeps a picture of her on his desk. Johnny Isaacson helped get justice for our daughter in Benin. He also was able to help get a law passed that better protects Peace Corps volunteers. I'm a lifelong Democrat. I'm so grateful that he was my senator.
I'm Johnny Isaacson, and I approve this message.
Is there a possibility that Johnny Isaacson could pull in Democrats from the other side of the aisle?
Isaacson has a real reputation as kind of an affable, nice guy to work with. And that's something, you know, especially for a lot of these Democrats who've been on the political scene for a long time in Georgia, they have perhaps positive memories of working with Johnny Isaacson. And that has sometimes translated in terms of endorsements, in terms of money. We saw that former Senator Sam Nunn, former Governor Roy Barnes, they quietly donated to his campaign a show of support. So we possibly could see that. And the ad that you just played, that was a very naked ploy for, to try and get Democrats and women on board as well. He's really taken pains to show that he's not this partisan candidate, but somebody who is willing to work across the aisle.
For those of you listening, we'd love to know if you're paying attention to the Georgia Senate race, which is pretty important. We'll explain why in a moment. But we want to hear your thoughts. You can tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation on Facebook. My guest is Tamar Hallerman, the Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. So, Tamar, I mentioned that the Senate race here is important, and we have a couple fairly recent polls. There was a poll on August 8th that gave Isaacson a 9-point lead, but the most recent AJC poll from August 5th gives Isaacson only a 6-point lead, which is tiny compared to where we thought we would be. But there are some other statistical models that show the control of the Senate could be up for grabs. What's the chances that the Senate race in Georgia could help determine control of the Senate in D.C.?
I am not sure how likely that is. At the end of the day, Jim Barksdale, the Democrat, still has a lot of work that he needs to do in terms of introducing himself to voters, getting on the same footing as Johnny Isaacson in terms of selling his message. Right now, he still is in introductory mode. Until we see a race that's, within, 1, 2, 3 points, I'd be skeptical to
say... You mean within the margin of error?
Yeah, exactly. I'd be skeptical to say that this could throw the entire balance of power in the Senate, toward the Democrats. But it is still pretty amazing to see. This race was not supposed to be a close one. And this shows how much, the divisiveness of Donald Trump at the top of the Republican ticket.
Could be hurting down ticket candidates. But here's another reason people are thinking about this, and that's because the Libertarian candidate, the independent, Alan Buckley, he's run for Senate before. Now, in 2008, he got barely 3% of the vote, which, as I understand, is about how much support he has now in the polls. And that 3% forced a runoff. If neither candidate gets more than 50% of the vote here in Georgia, it goes to a runoff. So it's possible that we could see the Senate race end up in a runoff situation, is it not?
Absolutely. And that is the last thing that Johnny Isaacson or Jim Barksdale wants. Not only is it expensive and exhausting to run a runoff campaign, this will stretch into early 2017. It's expensive. After months of campaigning, it's kind of the last thing you want. And Buckley does show that, you know, especially if he can kind of ride on the coattails of, you know, of Gary Johnson on the national level.
Gary Johnson, the libertarian candidate for president.
Exactly. If he can help capture some of that vote, and the most recent Atlanta Journal-Constitution poll showed that Gary Johnson now has double-digit support in Georgia. If he can even get some of that, that could easily push this race into a runoff.
So why are both at least Isaacson and Barksdale avoiding talking about Trump and Clinton?
It's pretty amazing to see. I'm surprised you're not seeing more of it. Johnny Isaacson has a lot of incentive to avoid Trump. On the one hand, he laid out in a speech on the sidelines of the Republican convention in Cleveland that, yes, he is supportive of Donald Trump. He will stick with the party's nominee. But since then, he's really tried to distance himself and keep Trump at arm's length. He said he's not willing to apologize for somebody else's gaffes. He's only responsible for himself. But at the same time, he's also made sure to not anger any Trump supporters in the Republican Party in Georgia. I'm surprised to see that he hasn't tried to attack Clinton. Staffers say that's just simply not Johnny Isaacson's style. As for Jim Barksdale, he's also steered clear of really highlighting some of the gaffes that Trump has had. You know, he's focused so far on Johnny Isaacson's record in the Senate. On the other hand, there have been some prominent Democrats, Atlanta Mayor Kasim Reed, the Reverend Raphael Warnock of the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, who have attacked Johnny Isaacson because of his support of Trump. So he is getting help there.
What idea do we have at this point, and what measures to predict turnout? Because as I understand it, Trump being on the ticket could actually increase turnout from Democrats, and yet fear that that Clinton could win Georgia could possibly increase turnout from Republicans. So any way to know?
That unclear at this point. I think some Democrats are worried that especially if Hillary Clinton is polling particularly well, that people will stay home. So you are seeing a more aggressive effort, especially on the Democratic side of the aisle, to especially register African-American voters, you know, to get them involved in this race. You know, we'll keep watching the polls, but at this point, it is looking like it's going to be a pretty high turnout election because of interest in the presidential race.
But to be clear, Johnny Isaacson is still predicted to win a re-election to his Senate seat.
Yes, at this point, it looks like it.
That is Tamar Hallerman, the Washington correspondent for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, talking about the Senate race here in Georgia. Tamar, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we're going to talk about how the innocent watermelon became a racist symbol. First, though, one veteran's journey from battlefield to farmland. And this is a great place to get your comments on this particular story coming up. We're going to talk about how some veterans have found alternative pathways to mental health and physical health by farming, which is a surprising story. But I wonder for you, what kind of alternative pathways or solutions, health solutions, have you found? What kind of hobby, what kind of profession did you find that may have helped you in a way that a medical doctor could not have? We would love to get those stories. You can tweet us at OST Talk. You can also post on Facebook or just give us a call and leave your message for us. The number is 404-500-9457. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. More than 500,000 veterans wait at least a month for appointments at the VA. That's 70,000 more veterans than last year, according to new data from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. As GPB's Sean Powers reports, there's now a new push in Georgia to improve veteran care by helping them connect with their roots on a farm.
On a 25-acre farm in rural Milledgeville in Baldwin County, John Jackson looks through a gate separating him from his goats.
Animals don't care about your bad day. They're going to come up and they're like, I want you to pet me. You know, and you're like, but I'm feeling really mad right now, but I'm petting you. And man, they don't know the amazing stuff that they're doing for our vets who come through.
It's been a long journey for Jackson, going from battlefield to farmland. He served 6 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he returned home with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. Getting care has been a challenge. Initially, he was seeing a psychiatrist at the VA center in Tuskegee, Alabama, but he says he was told he had to wait 6 months between appointments. Last year, he had a meltdown. He called the VA's crisis hotline, and he says the earliest they could see him was in 8 weeks. After a lot of pushing, they moved that up to 2 weeks, but Jackson says it shouldn't have been that hard.
Every appointment that I got with them was because it was like, no, I need to see you right now, you know? And I had to push it, and it was like, I'm fighting. And then you get sick and tired of fighting. Why am I fighting for care? Well, guess what happened within that 6 months? I come back, and I found out I got diabetes. There's nobody watching John Jackson.
Well, that's not entirely true anymore. Instead of waiting for care, Jackson wanted more immediate attention. So he moved to Milledgeville with his family, started going to a nearby VA facility in Dublin, where he says care is better, and he started a farm. It's called Comfort Farms, named after a friend of Jackson's who was killed in action in Afghanistan. Comfort Farms is ripe with everything from okra and tomatoes to chickens and pigs. For Jackson, farming fits like a glove as he readjusts civilian life with the scars of war.
You know, farming is chaos, and I like chaos, so it's just like one of those things where I'm constantly here struggling against Mother Nature, struggling against pests, you know, but, you know, when you win, you get those small battles, those small victories.
Veterans coming back from conflict often struggle with transition to civilian life. They have higher rates of depression and suicide, and they're more likely to be unemployed. Jackson hopes to change that by introducing more vets to farming. He's got a USDA grant to travel the state, training vets on agriculture. 150 vets and their families have visited his farm so far this year. One of them is Thomas Scott Kennedy, who also suffers from PTSD.
Get some speed going, get these flies out of here.
I'm in his car as we ride to the VA center in Dublin, where he has 3 appointments that were scheduled a little less than a month ago. VA data released this month shows, on average, 92% of vets with appointments are waiting 30 days or less for care. Kennedy says working on Comfort Farms helps him while he waits.
You're dealing with the VA on a every other week, every once a month type situation where in the farming environment with John at the farm, I mean, every morning you're up doing something, you're taking care of the animals, you're looking outward, you're not looking inward.
And that's a huge leap from where he was a few months ago. During Memorial Day, he charged headfirst into the side of his house. His family watched in horror as blood ran down his head. His wife applied for a protective order. A judge ordered Kennedy to stay away from his family for a year.
And that basically sent me over the edge again. And that's when I went in the woods and started taking the medications in order to end my life.
Investigators in Oglethorpe County are looking for a missing Marine veteran who they say could be suicidal. 49-year-old Thomas Scott Kennedy, last seen June 2nd.
A friend found Kennedy and connected him with John Jackson. Now Kennedy lives on Jackson's property on one condition, that he helps him on the farm. Melinda Page is a counselor in Atlanta. She works with people suffering from PTSD, and she says having them work together, like on a farm, can help stimulate brain activity.
They do better when they have a shared mission. They're extremely resilient, strong individuals. And since PTSD is a medical condition, it's a treatable medical condition, it means their brain is simply injured by the high stress that they've lived with and can be healed.
Nearly half of veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan are from rural areas. But the USDA says very few go into farming. The director of the Dublin VA sees her center's location in rural Georgia as an opportunity. Mary Alice Morrow is talking with the state's Department of Agriculture about growing fresh produce on site that can be used in her center's cafeteria.
We house approximately 115 veterans in our mental health rehabilitation program that helps veterans with homelessness, PTSD, substance abuse and or a combination of those get back on their feet. And they're usually here for a period of 60 to 90 days. So it would be a great way to teach them new skills or give them something to do while they're here. Could be therapeutic.
Now, there's still a lot of unknowns about the benefits of farming for veterans, but it may take off as the nation's farmers get older and the VA searches for ways to improve care while cutting down on wait times. For GPB News, I'm Sean Powers in Atlanta.
And we got a tweet from Steve Patterson who says, living with a life-threatening condition for 5 years, I have found little in mainstream med and chose the spiritual path, hashtag shamanism. So you can send us your cares of alternative pathways to health at OST Talk. But, you know, veteran care is a pretty important issue for my next guest as well.
Our veterans returning home, they really do need our help. These are people who took an oath saying that they would die for our freedom. And we want to be sure that as lawyers, we give back to them as well.
That is the voice of Atlanta attorney Linda Klein. She is the new president of the American Bar Association. It's the largest legal organization in the world, and her top priority is to provide more legal aid to veterans. She joins me now. Linda, it's a pleasure, and congratulations.
Thank you very much, and I'm glad to be here.
So how does the American Bar Association, how can the ABA influence care of veterans?
There are many ways, and I'm very excited about the things that lawyers are doing all over the country. As you heard in your previous segment, Americans, military veterans often continue to make sacrifices long after they've come home. There are service-connected injuries and other conditions that can be very debilitating, and it makes it nearly impossible for veterans to navigate the system that stands between them and their care. And as you saw in your previous segment, untreated, these wounds can lead to loss of a job, loss of housing, and for some, it can lead to an encounter with the criminal justice system. And so veterans returning home after persistent combat exposure and redeployment and separations from their families often encounter a variety of legal problems, family law disputes, child custody problems, evictions, denial of benefits, as we've heard, and credit problems.
What's your pitch to lawyers? How do you convince someone to do pro bono work? Because we are talking about pro bono work, are we not?
Yes, almost exclusively. And we're talking about pro bono work where lawyers help veterans, for sure, veterans who cannot otherwise afford lawyers. But there are a variety of other things that the American Bar Association is going to be doing this year. I can tell you that in previous years, and including the volunteers at the State Bar of Georgia, and I'll give you information about how to contact them too, and the volunteers at some of the law school clinics, like the one at Emory University, work very hard to help veterans. But in the ABA, we're looking at a more nationwide effort, and I have appointed a 20-member commission that's headed by Nan Dorenzi, who is a retired 3-star vice admiral, and a lawyer named Dwight Smith from Tulsa, Oklahoma. And among their goals are going to be looking at issues besides pro bono help, like employing medical legal partnerships to pair VA facilities with lawyers. And by bringing a lawyer onto the medical team, often the lawyer can solve the underlying problem for the veteran. Or promoting veteran treatment courts. We have one in the state in Athens. And expanding veteran treatment courts so not only do they deal with the veteran's criminal law problems, if there are any, but some of the civil problems they have, like debt collection and family law. We're going to ask bar associations to look at incubator programs where younger lawyers or lawyers who might be underemployed can learn how to help veterans with their legal problems and increase the number of people who can help. Another problem we've seen is that, like most Americans, many veterans don't know that the problem they have is a legal one, and so we're going to be looking at legal checkups. Where, just like you'd go to the doctor once a year for a medical checkup, you'll get a legal checkup to find out if some of the problems you have are legal problems. We haven't talked much about homeless veterans, and you need to know that the fastest growing homeless population in America are women veterans. And right now in the U.S., we have 40,000 homeless veterans, and that's a big problem. It's certainly a big problem in cities. A lot of the homeless people in Atlanta are veterans. Those are some of the things that we're going to be looking at in addition to asking lawyers to provide pro bono help, we're going to do two pro bono celebrations where lawyers from all over the country are going to try to do pro bono work for veterans around the same time. One will be between the last week in October and Veterans Day, November 11th, and the other will come around Memorial Day. If there are any lawyers listening, please go to celebrateprobono.org to sign up to help.
So, I mean, it's clear that you are very passionate about this. And why? Why is this a priority for you particularly?
The quote that you used for me from an earlier interview really says it all. These are men and women who took an oath saying they would die for us, for our country, in defense of our liberty. And when our justice system fails these people, lawyers must recognize that the sacrifice of veterans rests on something dear to the legal profession, the protection of the rule of law throughout the world. And that's why we as lawyers invoke our own oath and answer on behalf of veterans.
Is there also a difficulty in getting the information out to someone? I mean, you're talking about a lot of different programs that you want to offer through the ABA. And I wonder how you let veterans know that those things are available.
There are a lot of organizations throughout the country, veteran service organizations, VSOs, that deal with veterans. There are places at veteran care facilities that are run by the VA that have this information. There are various websites. The ABA website, ambar.org/veterans, is another way to find that information. And specifically for Georgia, gabar.org is the State Bar of Georgia's website, and I can give a phone number for veterans who need help.
We'll post it at our website. My guest is Atlanta lawyer Linda Klein. She is the new president of the American Bar Association. Tell me about that job, president of the American Bar Association. I heard one lawyer refer to the ABA as a little bit like herding cats. Do you think of the ABA as a unified organization?
The wonderful thing about the American Bar Association, as large as it is, there are over 3,500 entities. And because of that, we can serve lawyer needs, we can serve access to justice needs, which is the most important thing that we do. And there's something for everyone and everyone's interest. There's an enormous amount of public service, there's an enormous amount of service to the profession and the rule of law internationally.
What kind of influence do you then have as the president of this organization with so many arms and organizations? What do you see as the greatest benefit for you?
The benefit for me is being able to make a difference. That's why I became a lawyer, and that's why I enjoy my bar service. I was privileged to also be president of the State Bar of Georgia 19 years ago, and with that, we got to make a difference for so many people, and that's what I intend to do as ABA president here in helping veterans and with some of our other initiatives.
Do you think that the ABA occupies a position of... Well, let me ask it a different way. Do you think that the ABA retains credibility because of nonpartisanship? Has the ABA, to your mind, been able to rise above some of the polarization that other organizations have gotten kind of entangled in?
I believe so. The ABA is a nonpartisan organization. In fact, one of my other initiatives as ABA president is to ask lawyers to encourage their clients, their friends, and their communities to vote. And it is ambar.org/vote is a place where you'll find some of that information. And that the idea is that we believe that every American has the right to vote and the privilege to vote as part of our cornerstone of our democracy. And we never endorse candidates. In fact, the ABA does lobbying and it has no PAC.
No political action committee.
Correct. No political action committee.
So you don't pay money to go to Capitol Hill in Washington and push an agenda?
No, but we have lawyers and others who work with us on funding legal services for the poor and reforms to the criminal justice system. And we work with members of Congress, but we don't contribute to them.
Linda Klein is an attorney in Atlanta, the new president of the American Bar Association. Linda, when did you start your new job?
I still have my old one where I'm a partner at the law firm of Baker Donaldson here in Atlanta. So this is just another job that I've added to that. And I started it on August the 9th. And so I'm fairly new to this position.
Yeah, absolutely. Congratulations again, and thank you so much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Linda Klein, Atlanta attorney, as you just heard, still practicing and new president of the American Bar Association. Coming up, we'll talk about craft beer and what happens when craft beer goes mainstream. And you know, we have a lot of listeners that like beer. So this is the time to raise your voices and let us know, what is the difference between craft beer and mainstream beer, say Coors? Let us know. This is on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. School police officers are using tasers on students from kindergarten to high school. That's according to an investigation from the Huffington Post. We'll speak with the reporter about on tomorrow's show, and we want to know what you think. Are schools imposing harsher punishment on students than they did in the past? And should they? Call us at 404-500-9457 to be part of that discussion, and then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Beverage giant Miller Coors announced this month it bought a majority stake in Athens-based brewery Terrapin Beer Company. That news came as a big disappointment to Atlanta writer Jim Varel. He wrote a commentary about the merger for Atlanta Magazine, and it's called, "This is how Terrapin quietly sold out to big beer and betrayed its fans." He says the merger is the latest in a trend of big beer buyouts, and Jim joins me now via Skype. Hi there, Jim.
Hi there, Celeste.
Can we talk about the trend first? How big a trend do you think this is, craft brewers or local brewers selling out or being bought out by the big beer industry?
It is a huge trend in the beer world right now, because that's really the only segment of craft of beer that has been growing in recent years. The share of domestic light lager like Miller Lite or Bud Light, et cetera, has been shrinking. There's just fewer people drinking that kind of beer and more people trying craft beer. So they have had great incentive to try to acquire as many as they possibly can. And both MillerCoors and Anheuser have been very active in snapping up kind of mid-sized regional breweries.
What do you think is driving those mid-sized regional breweries to sell out?
Well, I mean, you can't begrudge them for wanting to sell out in general. Most of them are older. Most of them have been around for a while, and that's how they grew into mid-sized ones and successful businesses. Obviously, they're going after successful breweries that have good kind of local reputations. A lot of them are founded by guys who are now middle-aged. So some of them were, you know, younger guys when they founded these companies, and they just want to get out of the business, and that's their prerogative to do that. And they kind of want to cash out, and maybe they don't have a son to pass it on to or, you know, something like that. So they're looking for outside money to purchase these companies. But the problem in my eyes is that it's Anheuser and Miller that is probably ponying up the most money to purchase them.
And why is that a problem? Do you think the beers change flavor or character when say Miller buys Terrapin?
It depends. They have learned that the best way is to not mess with that kind of thing. It's a question of whether it matters that the ownership has changed if the product is still good. It's a question of beer politics, honestly, and not wanting your favorite local brewery to be owned by a company that is actively lobbying against other craft breweries in your state.
Wait, what do you mean by that? You think that Miller Coors is actively lobbying against craft brewers in Georgia?
Yes. So Georgia is one of two or three states left in the country where you can't go into a brewery and buy a pint of beer.
Right.
We have no, you know, service laws like that. There's no self-distribution and everything. And the reason why, I mean, we have a, state legislators that have historically been against that legislation, often Republican legislators who say that they're for committed for small businesses. And yet they have historically been against any legislation to modernize that beer law. And it just so happens that many of those same legislators also get campaign contributions from local distributorships or from Anheuser or Miller Coors directly.
Okay, so what is the big concern here? If it depends, I mean, it doesn't sound like the big concern is the taste of the beer. Is that right?
Right.
The big concern is the fact that you're losing a local employer? Or is it these I guess you called it beer politics? Is it the fact that the large brewers, like Miller Coors, then end up trying to shut down craft brewers throughout the state?
Exactly. It's sort of, it's that you have to be cognizant now of the fact that if you're buying Terrapin, your dollars are going ultimately into the coffers of a business that is lobbying to make life harder for the other small brewers and make it harder for those laws to get changed. Georgia still right now is among the lowest in the country in terms of breweries per capita. We're a large state. There's a lot of population in Georgia, and yet we're still very close to the bottom of that. I think maybe the bottom five in terms of breweries per capita. And it's because no one wants to really open craft breweries here compared to other states because the law is so bad for them.
Before I let you go, Jim, you also had a problem with the announcement. Did you not? You were concerned or upset or disappointed that Terrapin chose to not announce that they were merging with Miller Coors until the last minute. Why is that?
They did eventually. It was unusual. It's not the way that these usually go down, where it gets announced by the brand itself with a lot of pomp and circumstance. Instead, they let 10th and Blake, which is Miller Coors' craft acquisition arm, announce it themselves, and they didn't announce it. Terrapin didn't actually make the announcement for more than 48 hours afterward, which I thought was unusual. At first, I thought maybe they were trying to just sweep it all under the rug, but it's almost not as necessary now for them to do so because the reaction to these buyouts has become much less vitriolic in the last few years because fans of craft beer, even the ones who care about this kind of issue, have kind of gotten this attitude of resignation or helplessness that they can't do anything about it.
Obviously, you are not there yet. That is Jim Varel, the news editor for Paste Magazine. You can find a link to his commentary on how Terrapin sold out to Big Beer. It's available at gpbnews.org. Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And that's one view of mergers between craft brewers and large brewing companies. If you have another view or any view that you want to share with us, of course, we always welcome your views. Speaking of food that's locally grown and produced here in Georgia, though, watermelon season is just about over. We only have a month left in summer, period. But if you were planning to enjoy one of those sweet, succulent red treats, your time is running out. The watermelon was once a symbol of pride for freed slaves in the South. It has since taken on all kinds of racial meanings, and we wanted to explore why that is. Pat Turner joins us. She's a professor of African American Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles, and author of the book Ceramic Uncles and Celluloid Mammies, Black Images and Their Influence. Pat, it's good to have you.
It's good to be here.
Watermelon. When did the change occur, by the way, in between watermelon being something that Mark Twain praised in his writing and people just talked about a delicious fruit to something that is associated with a particular race?
Well, I think that the association of blacks and watermelons really dates to the minstrel era in the middle of the 19th century. This is the time period where the most popular stage shows involved white men dressing up in blackface and mocking and deriding black life as they perceived it in the South. They would exaggerate the size of their lips, the clothes would be sloppy and slovenly, and these stage shows became enormously popular really through the end of the 19th century, past the Civil War, and there was a whole subset of them called Tom shows, which were modifications of Uncle Tom's Cabin that became musicals and were really popular.
And it became, the watermelon became part of those minstrel shows? Why?
Food became part of the way in which popular culture could convey an image of blacks as savage. So any food that you could eat with your hands, watermelon, fried chicken, corn on the cob, these were the foods that were given to denote African-American characters as not having the civility that comes with eating with utensils.
This has become a controversy. Before we get to some of the more modern controversies, let's go back to the 1970s and hear a little bit of the TV show All in the Family. And in the scene, not surprisingly, it was his character, Archie Bunker, is expressing his distaste over integration in his neighborhood.
Archie, 12% of the population is black. There should be a lot of black families living out here.
Yeah, this is only a beginning, but I think it's wonderful.
Wonderful, huh? Well, let's see how wonderful it is when a watermelon rinds come flying out the window.
How did we get to the point where that became ubiquitous? Any ideas? Because we went from minstrel shows until we get to the 1970s where you don't even have to explain the racist joke.
Yeah, it never subsided. And when I say minstrel shows in the 19th century, think about the most popular tweeters today. You know, think about when you think about popular culture, this was on the covers of sheet music when sheet music was a primary way in which people communicated music. I've explained this to my students that before people even bought records, they bought sheet music because you played music yourself on your piano at home, the covers of which had blacks sitting on watermelons, spitting watermelon seeds. So it goes from one generation of popular culture item to another, all the way up and through All in the Family.
I want to play two clips for you, if I could. And we're speaking with Pat Turner, professor of African American Studies at UCLA, about watermelon and how it became a stereotype for a particular race. So in 2014, the Boston Herald published a cartoon, and the cartoon was actually about security breaches at the White House, but it featured the president, President Obama, brushing his teeth, and there's an intruder in the White House who asks the president, "Have you tried the new watermelon-flavored toothpaste?" That caused an uproar, and the cartoonist Jerry Holbert told WMUR-TV that it never occurred to him people would see that as racist.
I just think watermelon's a flavor. It's a popular flavor right now, and that I would go ahead and use it. And maybe this is very naive, and I'm sure that it is. It's very naive on my part, but I just don't think like that. And I really didn't think other people thought like that, especially up here in the Northeast.
So let's contrast that, a white cartoonist explaining that he never occurred to him to think of a watermelon as racist, with comic Phoebe Robinson, who says she avoids eating watermelon around white people. She's speaking here with WNYC's podcast, The Sporkful.
So I was in Whole Foods, and I was in the checkout line. They had like this thing called like watermelon juice, and I felt like they were mocking me. Like, I can't put that in my cart, because everyone who goes to like Yoga to the People will think that's what black people do. Right. So I'm like, I'm gonna leave that there, but I can't do it. Like, when I dated my ex, he was white, I dated for 4 years, I never ate watermelon in front of him.
When we talk about the watermelon as a symbol for black culture, is that something that there is a racial divide even on how we perceive that?
I think it can be. I do think that reporter was probably correct in his self-assessment that he was particularly naive. You know, if he's a professional journalist, I think he ought to be a little bit more in touch with certain things than that was indicated. But African Americans, many of us grow up being taught from our earliest days how to avoid conforming to the negative stereotypes that our parents and grandparents had to deal with. So the comedian had heard from her parents about the days in which it was far more ubiquitous and all of the things, and not eating watermelon is just one in an inventory of things. You know, don't be late, and, you know, make sure your hair is neat, and use proper English, and walk proudly. A whole inventory of behaviors that are intended to negate any holdover of the negative stereotypes.
And you grew up eating watermelon with a fork.
My father grew watermelon.
But you didn't eat it with your hands.
Well, my mother, we didn't eat it with our hands around white people. We ate it with our hands within our own circle, but I grew up in a fairly integrated setting, so there were times when, we had white guests. We were a little bit actually unusual, considering it was the 60s and 70s. So there was a little bit more integration in my community than there is in many. But any time there would have been a white guest, the option of putting watermelon on a plate and having a fork to eat it would definitely have been there.
And we have this tweet from Kalina who says, I've talked openly of my love for watermelon in the break room. It's extremely healthy, healthful, and delicious. I'd never be ashamed of it. And then Black Physicist tweets, I love watermelon, and I don't care what the people say. It's really good as a cold summer soup and with mint and feta in a salad. I can say watermelon with feta is just delicious.
I agree. I make watermelon with feta myself these days. But I serve it with a fork, because how can you eat the feta without
you can't. Yeah, you need the fork.
Yeah.
But Pat, are we coming to the point, especially when we have to look back through history and go back as far as minstrel shows to trace this tradition, are we now getting to the point where this particular stereotype might be ready to die out within a generation or so?
I think it's possible. It's often hard to for stereotypes to die. You know, if you or your listeners Google, put Obama and watermelon in Google Images, you will come up with lots of very contemporary cartoons making that association with him. There's something very, very tenacious about stereotypes and about derogatory images that makes them very hard to eradicate completely.
Yeah, I just did that. Googled Obama watermelon in Google Images, and I don't actually recommend that to anybody else.
Pat. And you'll be able to fill in with the next prominent African American celebrity public figure. You know, it just goes from one generation to the next.
Meaning that it's not just Obama.
Yeah.
Pat Turner is a professor of African American Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles, author of the book Ceramic Uncles and Celluloid Mammies, Black Images and Their Influences. Pat, thanks so much for waking up early for us.
Thank you.
That is our show for today, but watermelon is not the only fruit that will soon be out of season. As I mentioned, we are very close to the end of summer completely. So we're almost ready for the fall, and I want to know what your favorite autumn food is. What do you look forward to eating every single fall? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can leave a message there. Hopefully it's not pumpkin spice. We're on Twitter at OST Talk or post to Facebook. I'm kidding. If you love pumpkin spice, tell us. We're happy to hear that as well. For today, that's On Second Thought from GBB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.